I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax Views, T from Champagne Sharks, the podcast that describes itself as a distinguished but vicious exploration of issues related to race, racism, class, and culture from a left-wing perspective, joins us for a wide-ranging discussion of current hot topics in left media spaces. From Bernie Bros, Donut Twitter, and other tills from the internet culture wars, to the language of privilege and the debate between intersectionality and class reductionism, this is an extremely wide-ranging conversation. And because of its length, I'm going to just allow listeners to jump right into the conversation. So without further ado, T from Champagne Sharks, the podcast that's distinguished but vicious. Welcome to Parallax Views, T of the Champagne Sharks podcast. How are you doing tonight?
I'm pretty good. And I'm open. So I go by a nickname T, but you don't have to worry about not saying my name. My people know my name is Trevor Beaulieu. And I know some people think that I use T out of some fear of using my name, but you can use either interchangeably. Like, I let people call me T. I like being called T, but you could call me either way. But yeah, good to be here. I'm glad. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, I wanted to have you on because I've been listening to Champagne Sharks since I don't know when it was that Michael Brooks had you on his show, but it was a while ago, and I've enjoyed it ever since.
And he had me pretty soon after I started, so it was like, it had to be like 2 years ago. I think it's been going on for about 2 years at this point.
I like the description of your podcast on SoundCloud, a distinguished but vicious podcast about culture, politics, and race. Maybe you could tell my listeners a little bit more about the podcast and sort of what you mean by that description.
The podcast is basically kind of like the podcast I always wanted to hear, but nobody was really making it. So I made the podcast, and what I wanted was to not be troll. I feel like a lot of things are either just very polite, or I don't like using the word PC because that sounds like really bad now when you say that, because it sounds like I forget what that's part of that whole cancel culture talk. I hate the word, the term PC, but it's really the only thing I could think of. Like, I feel like a lot of things were kind of safe. Yeah, let's say safe. A lot of things would either be safe and boring and not really make you think, or they would just be edgy to be edgy and just be like mean for no reason. So like Distinguished But Vicious was like kind of like I wanted to be soft-spoken and not trying to be edgy for edgy's sake, but have provocative things to say. Cause I kind of felt that middle was missing, at least in so far as race podcasts and race dialogue was going. I wouldn't say it was missing, period. I don't like flatter myself to think that it was a space I was carving out like in the whole culture in general, but I just thought in particular with the race stuff, it was three things. Either it was very like PC, NPR-ish, white ally industrial complex type stuff, or it was just some like really edgy stuff, or very kind of radical, or just about nothing, like frivolous, like just about sports, TV, things that would be dated like in a week. Like, for example, and this is not, I'm not saying this like in a shade way. This is not like a insult, but something like Beasts and Mero would cover like a lot of topics, but it's the kind of thing where if you listen to it 2 weeks from now, it's already dated. Like, it's very of the moment and it's kind of like forgettable. And I wanted something that was not tied to a time or a topic. You can kind of listen to it at any time and get some insight out of it.
Yeah, so many podcasts get into sort of just being about current events, and they like really sort of age and date themselves badly.
Yeah, I feel like even if I'm doing something about current events, I want to give it a takeaway that ties into like something more timeless. That's why I like talking about like the psychology of things, or the dynamics or the history of something, because I feel like even if you make it topical, you can still kind of tie it into like the through line of history or the through line of culture in general. You know, like I think a lot of things just talk about the people and events of something, and when it's just like a litany of that stuff, it's really easy to become dated, because once the event is passed or no one cares about it anymore, why really listen to that thing?
I also got to ask, where does the name come from, Champagne Sharks? I may be missing some type of reference there.
No, it's meant to be like weird and confusing on purpose, because I think that kind of gets... Well, first, I like it. That's kind of alliterative. I don't know how you pronounce it. Alliteration. I like that part of it, but I just spent a lot of time trying to think of two words that don't go together, and to put them together so that if you were to ever Google a name, it would be the only thing that ever pops up. So I said Champagne and Sharks. How often is someone going to Google Champagne Sharks and something else is going to pop up? Because there's things like the show Girls by Lena Dunham. And I was thinking, like, what a dumb thing to name a show. Because once you put girls in, a million things will pop up. Probably a lot of porn and stuff. And, you know, I was thinking, if I make something, I want to make something that's the only thing that's going to pop up. And ironically, after I did it, there's actually a minor league team somewhere called like the Champagne Sharks or something. So it still didn't end up working.
I've had that problem myself, actually, because the name of my show being Parallax Views, for some reason, even though I add the S in at the end, whenever people type in Parallax Views on Google, they get the old 1970s conspiracy thriller movie with Warren Beatty. That comes up instead of... And the movie's called Parallax View, not Parallax Views. But it still comes up rather than my podcast usually, which I find really odd because I add S to it.
You know what probably happens? Probably because it's a movie. The word view was in there a lot. So that might be what it's picking up on.
Right, right.
But Champagne Sharks has a different meaning too. Like, like the meaning I came up with, like after I came up with the name, but what I thought it applied to was like distinguished but vicious. The champagne is distinguished, but the shark is vicious.
I like that. I like that. And I guess, what would you say the main topics you cover are for maybe my listeners that aren't as familiar with the podcast? I'm sure I have a few listeners that have listened to it over time, but for listeners that may be unfamiliar, maybe you could introduce it a little bit.
Sure. The podcast, I'd say, is like really it's just about like what's on my mind a lot. But what tends to be on my mind tends to be like when I look at events and things that are happening and all this stuff, I always try to kind of look at like, why is this happening? Like, don't just accept the premise that's being presented to you. Like, why is this being discussed now? Who is this for? Why do they phrase it this way? Because I feel like a lot of times people just discuss things with the frame that they're presented it with. So, I think of an example.
I think the Bernie thing is a good example of that. This whole narrative of, you know, if you're a Bernie supporter, you're immediately a Bernie bro. And everyone is dismissed. I mean, even if they're not one of those, I mean, there are rude people that are Bernie supporters. And those are the sort of type of people that, you know, the term Bernie bro was originally applied to. But now it's sort of like anyone that is a Bernie supporter can be called a Bernie bro. It's become sort of the narrative.
It's also kind of weird to me because with the Bernie bro thing, I think one thing that's kind of ironic about it is that I think it's the kind of thing they kind of made up out of whole cloth 2016. Like there was maybe a handful of people like that, but not really. They just kind of exaggerated that. Like, yeah, a lot of passionate people. But then I think the irony stuff kind of really ramped up because after Chapo came out, and I think a lot of people kind of bandwagon on trying to be like very ironic. So I think now, especially to like a normie or an outsider, the optics of it look a lot more like what they made up. So I think now they've kind of lucked into this aesthetic that they get to really kind of paint as, because to me it's like there's like a handful of I think people that are really really toxic, right? But I think most of it is just like just jokes, you know. And honestly, I don't think it's any worse if not actually less so than things like Donut Twitter, where they were all bothering Nina Turner and stuff like that. But
I don't know much about that. What's Donut Twitter? I know Nina Turner, but...
Okay, have you ever seen... I think a lot of them have gotten rid of this, but they kept it for disturbing me a long time. There were a lot of these, like, centrist liberals, Hillary types, who had donut emojis in their names, next to their names on Twitter. And what that was this thing to mock Nina Turner. And it was kind of weird that they really, really honed in on this and blew it up. But something happened where she was at some kind of event. I don't even remember the full details. She was at some kind of event and they made her wait, or they did something rude. And I might be wrong about the specific details, but something happened that was kind of disrespectful. And then they tried to placate her or like buy her off with like, here's some free donuts and coffee. And then, because a lot of these liberals, they can't stand her and blame her for being associated with Bernie, like anything with Bernie, like they hate, they started attacking her all day and saying that they changed the story to that she went to this kind of Democratic event and was mad because she didn't like the donuts. And she threw a big tantrum because... she didn't like the donuts, and they all put like donut emojis by their names as a way. It was like a kind of tribal thing that they all had for like a while, and a lot of them kept it for like a long time, and that wasn't even what it was about. She was mad about being mistreated or disregarded or being left to wait for like a long time or something like that, and then giving her buying her for donuts was like, you know, and it wasn't like the focal point of the rant or whatever. It was just a side thing. They just rephrased it into, hey, this is what Bernie's people are like, or Nina's a ridiculous person. She goes places, and if she doesn't like the donut, she flips out.
But what she was really mad about was like how she was treated, sort of feeling like she had to wait longer, things like that.
Yeah, and they basically were really abusive. Like they're abusive to a lot of people, and for some reason, I think maybe because in their mind they're on the side of good or something, because I think in some weird way they really do believe that, like they really do buy into this idea that Hillary and all these people are like heroes and stuff. Like I think they kind of buy into that their rudeness or whatever doesn't count because it's on the side of the good. I don't really know, but I find they can be really outrageous themselves. That's kind of the irony of the whole Bernie bro thing. I mean, it doesn't have the shitposting quality, and I think it's really kind of the shitposting quality that really pisses them off, because they really don't know how to respond to shitposting. They just don't know the rules of it. They don't know how to engage it or anything, and I think that's really what pisses them off about the whole Bernie bro thing. They just don't know how to respond to shitposting.
I mean, I've seen like tweets from the sort of anti-Bernie crowd where they're saying things like, I'll get specific. When he had the heart attack, there were people saying, you know, I hope he dies.
Oh, yeah. It's like,
you know, there may be like some toxic Bernie bros, like some toxic Bernie supporters, but I'm not sure this is like just supporters of one candidate. I think we have that amongst all kinds of different candidates in the Democratic field.
Oh, sure. And they also have people like, I think Ragnarok Lobster, he said something really sexually crass to Katie Halper, and it was really kind of gross. I forgot what it was. But a lot of times, especially like the female Bernie supporters, like a lot of them will say like really like sexist stuff and stuff that's just really gross, but nobody really cares. It's just kind of gets brushed under. It doesn't get reported on, whatever. It's, I don't know.
Yeah, it was interesting. Well, go on. I'm sorry.
No. I was going to say, it's just a matter of kind of not being online savvy either. Like, it's just a very disorienting thing, I think, to them to just see all these accounts with like ironic names, no avatar picture. The avatars are like weird pictures, like George W. Bush with glowing eyes and all this stuff. I think it kind of just looks really kind of scary to. I think boomers are a state of mind. It's not even really an age. And I think whether you're 20 or 70 in that crowd, you basically have a boomer brain. And I just think that, too, kind of disorients them about the whole thing.
I think that's true. It was interesting you mentioned, you know, the people who are really into the whole I'm with her Hillary thing. Even now, I hear that a lot. I've had conversations with people in that camp about Hillary's infamous super predators remark. And it's always been weird to me because I think super predators is like very explicitly racist. And they'll say, well, I've had a few of these people say to me something like, she was talking about gangs. And I'm like, you guys are really rationalizing this stuff here.
Oh, my God. How about when they rationalize the use of prison labor? That was my favorite. They were saying crazy stuff, including some of her black supporters. One thing that's weird, too, right? There were a lot of shills and stuff that were around the first time who between 2016 and 2020 have like disappear. Like, there was one called, like, Doc Rocket and all these other ones. And they just all, like, went away. Now there's, like, a bunch of new shills. But there, like, that first wave of shills, they were saying stuff about the prison labor she was using for Arkansas Mansion back when Bill Clinton was the governor. It was Arkansas, right? And
right.
And they were saying stuff like, hey, those people are cooped up in cells all day long. They actually enjoy being taken out to get some fresh air and stretch their legs and do that labor. And she was teaching them job skills and like all this stuff that they would not have let fly for anyone else.
Yeah, it gets really bizarre at times. I think there is sort of this sincerity to it where these people sort of think, you know, well, I'm on the right side of things. I think that you make a very good point there.
Yeah, I think they do, and I think even when they bullshit and they lie, they reach a point because there's something kind of childish about them in a certain way where they start believing their own stuff if they say it enough. So like once they rationalize it, I feel like they instantly internalize it. They will argue it like and get emotional like they really, really believe it within a blink of an eye. Like this whole thing with Bernie's full medical records and stuff, but when Hillary Clinton fainted, like they're acting like this is some kind of objective principle they have. But when Hillary Clinton fainted, I don't know if anybody started demanding her medical records, but you know, they wouldn't have gone for it. It's I don't know. The whole thing is so full of bad faith. It's really full of bad faith. And one thing that's interesting is how blatant, in my opinion, they're really trying to make it clear they're going to try to screw Bernie Sanders. Somebody said on Twitter, I wish I could remember who it was, but somebody joked that the way CNN covers Bernie Sanders is like how J. Jonah Jameson covers Spider-Man. And it really is true. Like that, and in that debate where they asked Bernie Sanders if he ever said something to Elizabeth Warren, and he was like, yeah, I never said that, whatever. Then asked Elizabeth Warren. So when he told you a woman would never be president, you know, this acted like he said the exact opposite. And the people in the audience like started like audibly laughing. I thought that was like it's getting that obvious now.
Well, I'm curious, where do you stand on Bernie Sanders? Are you a supporter? Are you indifferent? Like, what's your sort of take on Bernie?
With Bernie Sanders, I'm not like a kind of person that's super in the tank for him as far as being a kind of rabid supporter. I have some problems with certain things he does, but I do. And I'll elaborate on those later, but I do appreciate two things about him, and that is his consistency. He's pretty much been the same guy for a long time now, and you can always like find examples of his speeches and his stances, and they stay consistent. I think he is definitely the best option. I think he's the, like, there's two things I find. There's, like, people who I think buy into him almost in a messianic way. And I don't really buy into him in that way, or electoral politics in general in that way. Like it's good for what it is, especially in the national level. But, I don't really think electoral politics is really going to be the ultimate savior of anything on its own. So there's that. But there's also these people who, unless you get the perfect radical or the perfect socialist or whatever, nothing is good enough. And that I think is probably even more damaging. And
yeah, I've noticed a lot of people on the farther ends of the left saying, you know, sort of taking a never Bernie position now. They're like, well, he's not radical enough.
Yeah, I've noticed that too. And sometimes, and this isn't limited to socialists, I think this comes to a lot of people who have an outsider view to politics, in that I think a lot of times there's a certain fear of success that kind of happens. And this is, again, not limited to the left. I think you can see this with even the alt-right and Trump, like there's this kind of person that likes being the underdog, likes the uphill climb, likes the idea that everything's stacked against them, they can't win, and then they can just kind of rail online or spout theory all day or troll or do whatever. Like the alt-right was like that. And a lot of people don't remember this, but I remember when Trump became more and more feasible as an actual candidate, there were a lot of alt-right people that were very, like, rabidly happy and whatever, and they were really happy to own the libs and everything, in your face. But there were a lot of them who were like, suddenly they're like, oh, I think Trump's selling out. I don't like this. Trump's becoming too mainstream. Suddenly, nothing was good enough. Like they basically wanted him to say he was going to throw Chuck Schumer in the oven or something. Like, you know, they almost want him to just become an overt neo-Nazi or something like that. And I think for those people, it was like, if it's one thing to just react to things, you know, or to have all these crazy theories, but once you govern, you have to have some kind of positive vision for things. You have to compromise. You can create all these radical fantasies that you want, but real change in this current government system is probably going to be a lot more incremental, going to involve a lot more compromise. I think a lot of people get afraid of having to temper their ideas to the pragmatic real world, you know?
And
when they reach a position where it's like, okay, now we're not the underdogs, now we're the people in charge, what are we going to do now? And I think that's kind of a lot. And I feel like I've been reading these things from a lot of these further left people, which is, what they're saying is not wrong. Like, they'll be critiquing Bernie about things that he does that are not truly communist or socialist. They don't like how he describes things. They're saying stuff like, oh, I hate when he describes the current system as socialism for the rich, because that's not what socialism is. You're confusing people. And it's like, I know why he's saying that. He's not being literal. He's saying it to destigmatize socialism. Like, he's not trying to give a proper clinic in what socialism means. Like, you're not wrong that he's misrepresenting socialism in a way by labeling the current crony capitalism as socialism for the rich, but you have to be, like, pragmatic sometimes. Like, saying it that way kind of makes people think, hey, we're already living in a type of socialism. It's not this big otherwise boogeyman system, you know? And then, as long as you get the things done and on the back end, maybe educate people on what it really is, I think it might be an acceptable trade-off. But a lot of people kind of want, they let perfect be the enemy of good. And I think that happens in a lot of spaces. That happens in pro-black spaces, where it's like, there are people who will be in the pro-black space and they won't like anything unless it's just lobbing Molotov cocktails at white people 24/7, or it has no compromise. And I feel like that faction always gets more agitated and vocal when their camp looks like it's about to make, like, a real gain or actually get some real representation. I think that goes for whether it's pro-black radicals, whether it's leftist radicals, whether it's reactionary alt-right radicals.
You still with me?
I'm still.
Okay. I wanted to make sure you drop out.
That was done.
It's interesting. I wanted to talk at some point about issues related to race. Maybe we could get into some of your criticisms of Bernie before we do that, though.
Oh, yeah, that's actually a good segue, because that's part of my criticism with Bernie. Is I feel like too often he's always talking about, like, I get the idea that of lift all boats and that when you focus on class, it will disproportionately help black people. I get that idea, but I think a lot of times there's a certain naivete about it, about this idea that you can just do that and that socialism is somehow, and I know what people are going to say when I say this. They're going to say, oh, no one actually says these words. Point out somebody who says these words. And I know nobody says these words because I think people know to say these words is very volatile and absurd. But by implication, by the way that these people describe how socialism is supposed to work, in a way, by reading between the lines, you can tell they almost seem to be communicating this. And what that is the idea that socialism is somehow immune to racism, that socialism, if enacted correctly and perfectly done in a colorblind way, that racism can't thrive in it. It's just something that can only operate under capitalism. And that, I think, is kind of a naive way of looking at it. And I feel like a lot of times, like, I feel like Bernie's kind of made a choice, right? And I feel like he's kind of made this choice where it's like, if I can get the black vote, I'm not going to turn it down. But my priority is the white working class. I want to win the white working class back from Trump. And I think by making that his priority, he's done a lot of unforced errors that I think were really avoidable.
No, and I think that's a fair criticism. And I know people that will get very mad when anyone makes that criticism. But I think it's something that should be heard out, to be honest.
Yeah, I totally agree. But yeah, that's the other thing. A lot of people get very rabidly mad when anybody brings that up. And then the optics of that, I think, look bad too, because then people are like, oh, you guys can't even take any racial criticism of Bernie on race. Like, one of the problems that I find is there's no middle ground. So if you say anything about Bernie on race, suddenly you're kind of SJW identity politics thing. You're part of cancel culture. You support shadow representation in Disney movies. Like, they create a profile of you that's just such a caricature.
And even if you support Bernie, that's what's so weird about it.
Yeah, exactly. Even if you support Bernie, still they'll make that caricature of you. And so there's times where I've said something where, you know, I thought it was pretty mild, and a bunch of people go in my mentions, and then they'll be like, well, what about this? And it'll be something I don't even believe. You know, they'll be like, but it'll be this caricatured identity politics person. And they just made up in their mind that I believe all this stuff. So, you know, they'll be like, I'm sure you got when Obama did this. So I'm like, no, I don't like Obama. Like, why do you think I support that, you know? And so I think it's a problem that happens a lot.
Well, there's a really dark end to some of it too, because there's. Are you familiar with Stupid Poll, the subreddit?
Oh yeah, they've gotten into it with me like a lot online.
Oh really? I mean they go like really far with.
Oh yeah, and you know what's crazy about that, right? That's what's really funny. One thing with them that's really interesting is. In 2016, the common thing that kept being said whenever you tried to paint or bring up class reductionism was, oh, that doesn't exist in the wild. There's no such thing as class reductionism. And the first thing people always say is, oh, name these class reductionists. Who's the class reductionist? Whatever. And in the interim, it's like that subreddit has just been created just to give people something to point to as the worst caricature of a class reductionist. Like now you can point to a whole subreddit and a whole like legion of trolls that and I also think a lot of those types kind of made the Bernie bro stereotype like more real, you know, as far as some of the crazy things those people will say to people. They've helped manifest what I think was a more false made up label. They've kind of made, even if they're like a minority of Bernie supporters, they're vocal enough that they almost feel like way more than they are. If you ever get into it with them, they will be in your mentions like for like 2 or 3 days straight. Yeah, so I do think that they really do fit the stereotype of a class reductionist. But one of what's really interesting, one of the people who is big into the, oh, there's no such thing as a class reductionist, is Adolf Reed. And those guys love Adolf Reed. And recently, Adolf Reed, a couple months ago, did an article, The Myth of the Class Reductionist. And he was still sticking to this idea that class reductionism is a straw man that was made up by these identity politics people who don't want to talk about class. And I'm like, dude, come on. Like, you can't say that in 2019 still. Like, you know, it's not even plausible anymore. Like, there's a bunch of people, and a lot of them are like fans of you. And this is not me blaming him for stupid Paul, but I'm saying, like, you have to be with that fan base. You have to be at least a little bit aware that there's actual real class reductionists that are showing their ass every day now. You know what I mean?
No, I completely feel you on that. I mean, there's things I like about Adolf Reed, but I think it's unfortunate because I think a lot of times, people that I don't want to be associated with very much cling to him.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I like Adolf Reed, but I've been liking him kind of less and less because I feel to a degree he's kind of been moving a little bit toward that fan base. I feel like recently he's kind of, I don't know, some of the things he says lately, I'm still a fan of more of his like even relatively recent stuff, like as recent as like 2017, 2018, and he'll still make some pretty cogent points. But I feel like with the rise of like Stupid Paul, he's kind of catered to that base like a little bit too much for my taste. I mean, I'm not saying he's totally on board with them or he's reached their level, but I just feel like he seems a little conscious of the base and is kind of playing to it a little bit.
Yeah, and it's weird to me because I've basically always held the view that even if we had a socialist society, issues like misogyny, issues like racism, they don't necessarily change overnight just because you have created a socialist society. Maybe I'm missing something in the analysis of people who would argue that, but I just don't, it doesn't compute with me for some reason.
Well, one thing that's pretty interesting, this is one of the arguments that I hear, at least in involvement race, right? They say, like, race was created to...
Oh, is it the argument of, like, race was used to balkanize the sort of masses against each other, or...?
There's that one, but there's also the one before that where they say kind of, like, the concept of race was created to justify slavery because... you know, to enslave people, you kind of had to otherize them and dehumanize them. And capitalism was behind slavery. And this idea that racism was born out of capitalism because people needed to dehumanize and reduce people to, human capital in a way to reduce them, objectify them. And race made that easier. And there's a lot of black thinkers that people would probably think of as identity politics or race politics who have said the same thing. One of them is Joy DeGruy. Like, she is one of the people that she has a book called Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome, and she has this theory that I find is plausible. It's not that different than their theory, which is that that a lot of racism by whites comes from a cognitive dissonance from it's hard for them to think of something as human or alive or, you know, not an object and enslaved and mistreated. So in order to make slavery work, it was almost a necessary defense mechanism of their mind to authorizing, dehumanized black people and whatever. That's so, you mean, they're not like unique in thinking that. Like, they think that anyone who practices racial theories or critical race theory is unable to fathom that. But my problem with them is, just because race and racism might have been created or thrived under capitalism, that doesn't mean that when you take it away, it's going to go away, because now it's here. Like it's not going to erase the 400 or 500 years of conditioning that people have had generationally and in the laws and systemically to view and think of black people as human garbage and other races as human garbage. It's not like that is, I think, kind of this block that I think they have. They think that because something was introduced because of this, when you take away that thing, that tradition is going to disappear. Like, there's so many traditions that we have that the original thing that the tradition was made for doesn't even exist anymore. But we are so wedded to those traditions and ways of thinking. There's customs with marriage that, you know, were created with the idea of like joining property and all this patrilineal dowry and all these things, and all those things are gone, but those like valued traditions. Just, I think it's just a weird way of looking at it. This idea that you can take away, that because something arose under a certain condition or because of a certain condition, that you take that away and it's just going to disappear.
Right, right. Like the idea that if we can just transition to socialism, the issue of racism, since it may have came from capitalism, it'll just disappear overnight. Rather than maybe there's two issues that are related, but even if you transition to socialism, maybe that issue won't go away overnight. I just don't see the reason why. Like, it's so confusing to me that people have that view that you could just get rid of one thing and, you know, everything else will just magically change. It's very foreign to me.
Yeah, and also it's just unproven, because you have no idea if when, because people have made different types of arguments. They say, capitalism will actually erase socialism, capitalism will erase racism, because if you let a free market happen, black people can underbid everybody, and it's not in the workers, it's not in the boss's best interest to I'll give you an example that right wingers come up with. They say minimum wage and different socialistic things actually exacerbate racism, because if you have a minimum that you can pay people, then you take away bargaining power from poor people and minorities, because if you make this floor here, I can just afford to just hire nothing but white people and still have optimum profitability. But in a world where there's no floor, a black person or a Mexican or whatever, there's no limit to the bottom, and now these people can come in and the capitalist factory owner is going to be unable to resist hiring these black people, these Mexicans, these migrants, these whatever, because the deal's going to be too good. Like, and you somehow racistly taken away a bargaining chip that from these people. But in reality, anyone who's worked anywhere will tell you, like, bosses make irrational decisions all the time.
Right.
People will pass up profits and all types of things just out of spite. Like, even look at like Amazon. Like, Amazon would randomly, like, you'll see Amazon do these incredibly expensive legal battles and do all these different things just to avoid paying the workers a fair wage. Like, and the things that they'll pay to avoid giving those workers a fair wage is probably way more expensive and way more onerous, with no legal fees, discovery, hiring lawyers, court cases, all this stuff, shopping from city to city to, you know, find the place that'll give you the most tax breaks. Like, you almost think, like, just pay them $15 an hour. Like, what are you doing? You know, but yeah, people do irrational things all the time under capitalism. We'll lose the money just to, exert their will or do whatever.
So I guess this is a good lead into another topic I wanted to discuss with you, and that's the issue of intersectionality, because it seems like there's a big debate between a lot of people on the left over intersectionality. There's some people that are very supportive of it, whereas there's other people now who are just saying, oh, if you believe in intersectionality, you're just another liberal.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because it's just become such a buzzword. And one of the problems I kind of have is that you never know what people are talking about when they talk about it. But this kind of goes with everything. Like,
that's all, it's also true of the term identity politics, I think, as well.
I was actually going to say that next. Like, when two or three people talk about identity politics, you have no idea they're talking about the same thing. For example, like I was talking to somebody. Because this is one of the reasons why I stopped kind of arguing about it. Because when those stupid poll people were trolling me, and they were talking about identity politics sucks, this, that, blah, blah. And I was like, I brought up like Martin Luther King and the Black Panther, because they're bringing up the Black Panthers. And this is one thing I can't stand. Like, where people will take something like the Black Panthers or Martin Luther King, and they'll find like whatever three or four quotes that they said about socialism or communism, and then just present that. And I'm like, okay, you can't just do that. You can't just take somebody and then just use the one or two quotes they had about socialism that you like, and then erase everything else. Because at the end of the day, the Black Panthers and Martin Luther King, they were practicing identity politics. Like, you know, like you can't just pretend that because they were sympathetic to socialism or were leaning toward it or were even avowed socialists, that means they somehow excise identity politics from their range of belief. And then a bunch of these stupid poll types were telling me, no, are you crazy? Martin Luther King wasn't identity politics, or Black Panthers wasn't identity politics. And I was like, in what universe are they not identity politics? I don't understand this. Like, they're called like the Black Panthers, and they're talking about Black power, and Martin Luther King was advocating for reparations, and he had speeches. One of his last speeches was about, he was breaking down how white people in the New Deal did all this stuff to help the farmers and the poor and the poor immigrants, and did all the redistribution and left Black people out of a lot of those redistributive policies. And that, you know, he ended the speech with, we're coming for our check. Like, Black people need a certain amount of recompense that they were left out on when redistribution happened. And it was due to slavery and Jim Crow and all this stuff. But then I was like, well, what do you think identity politics is? And they're like, well... And then they start bringing up somebody from the Combahee Collective, who I guess coined it. And what I was thinking is like, okay, even if this woman coined the term identity politics, whatever her definition of it is, doesn't necessarily mean that that's what people mean by it now. Like, there's a lot of things where somebody invented a term or whatever, but the term evolves to mean different things. But the problem I'll have is when convenient, they'll use identity politics as this narrow thing that this lady who coined the term identity politics,
Barbara Smith,
yes,
she just came out saying that she was supportive of Bernie. Actually, yeah,
exactly, and she's came out saying that she supports Bernie. But the most frivolous things involving identity that I'm sure Barbara Smith would not include in her identity, her definition of identity politics, they're more than fine including that under I didn't like they're selectively rigid about what they call identity politics. It's just basically, if it's something that they can use to make identity politics look stupid, then it's identity politics. If it's something that is effective or useful, then somehow it's not identity politics. So,
isn't class itself part of identity?
Well, that's the thing that's kind of interesting, because they'll say it's not, but they act like it is, because they'll talk about it like it is. Like that Amy Tversley lady, when she talks about class, she's not even talking about material conditions. She's talking about trappings, like in tribal stuff, like you're in a coffee shop and you look this way and you hang out here and you work for these magazines, you know what I'm talking about? Like, a lot of these people, they treat class like an identity, even though they pretend that they're not doing that, you know? So it's like a black person with no generational wealth who happens to work for the Atlantic or whatever, you know, but or might be freelancing, you know, but they're part of the so-called PMC, you know, which is another term that means nothing now, because the person is not a manager or anything, but...
Right, the professional managerial class, yeah.
Yeah, and all that means to them is just a liberal is just means PMC. So, you know, to them, like, you know, this black person that, you know, maybe has a job and is not, quote unquote ghetto, not part of like the working class, even though he has no generational wealth or whatever, but a socialist who might have a trust fund and whose parents have money and stands to inherit a house, but you know, right now they don't have insurance, and maybe are what's it called? Is it called downwardly mobile, whatever? Like,
right? Yeah, yeah,
yeah, yeah. That person will be working class, even though, like, you know, their family might be upper middle class. They might come from generations of money. Like, material conditions are kind of not really part of how a lot of these people are viewing class. They're just viewing class, like you said, like an identity. It's like, are you in the in group or are you in the out group? Are you? Yeah, so I find that kind of interesting, that some people who probably really don't have a lot of money or don't come from money get kind of labeled as middle class or professional managerial, and some people who might come from money might stand to inherit money, you know, but are situationally broke, they're working class.
Yeah, it's interesting too. I didn't realize that there was like debates over Martin Luther King and intersectionality. My understanding of Martin Luther King, and one of the things that I think made him so radical, is that he believed, especially near the end of his life, that we had to connect all these different movements together, the anti-war movement, the movement to fight economic inequality, the movement to fight racism. All of these things were connected, and we have to work together in order to push back against the system as it currently is.
Yeah, and what's interesting with a lot of people, and this comes from both sides, is this kind of false choice that if you can prove somebody said one thing, then they must not believe in the other. So it's like, if you can prove that Martin Luther King was conscious of class issues, then you've proved that he didn't practice identity politics. And if you can prove that Martin Luther King cared about black issues, then you can prove that he was not sympathetic to socialism. And this idea, even though everyone claims that both are necessary, in practice, they act like it's impossible for someone to believe both. And what you said is exactly right. Like, he had a very complex belief system. But, you know, I'll even say something further, right? There was this kind of weird thing about how some certain people are kind of sacrosanct, and that they can't be wrong. So what happens is you have to twist what they believe into what you believe. Like, for example, it happened to Karl Marx too. Like, one thing gets on my nerves, right, is when people say they believe something and they feel like it's right. So then they have to write an article and it'll be like, the leftist case for blah, blah, blah. The leftist case for blah, blah, blah. And then the article will be more concerned with contorting this position into something that Marx would have believed if he was alive. And you have to try to imagine all this stuff Marx would have believed, or to show that Marx in his day believed in the equivalent of this issue that was in his day and stuff. And then sometimes maybe Martin Luther King or Marx would have seen this issue and had a totally different opinion. And you know what? They were wrong. That's like, it doesn't have to be supported by Marx or supported by Martin Luther King to necessarily be right. Like, I think it's kind of a trap we kind of fall into in the discourse as well.
Yeah, the discourse has gotten so weird in that way. Like, now everyone will say, if you disagree with one of their heroes, you're a hater.
Yeah.
It's almost like you have to agree with everything, and then people will say you're a stan. You're either a stan or a hater. And I'm thinking to myself, isn't there any nuance anymore? What happened?
Oh yeah, there's no middle ground. Like I was telling somebody, right? Like, I remember when stan, when it came out, was a pejorative. It was a insult, like, as in the song Stan, that was not like a cool thing to be. Like, the whole thing that he's kind of crazy, and the idea was that
he's too obsessed. He's obsessed. It's like, if you're a fan of anything in any way, well, you're just a stan now. It's bizarre.
But people say it now, also own it. Like, you know, they have things like Stan Twitter, Stan Tumblr, I Stan, but everyone skips fan. A stan was supposed to be like an outlier. Like, most people were fans, and then a stan was this small group of fans who took it too far. But now stan is a default way to be a fan. Like, no one wants to be a fan or in a fan club. Everything people jump from, either not knowing it or not being a fan, or they jump straight to stan status. Because, like, I notice sometimes a show or a movie or a figure even will come out, and people will be rabid for this person in a week. And I'm like, there's no way organically you can be this crazy about this show. Like, you have like an account dedicated to it, 50 GIFs a day, you know, shipping characters from it. You're getting to rabid arguments. And it's like, this thing came out a week ago. Like, you're forcing it. Something is going on. So I think on both sides, there's people who like things who think, okay, I have to be a stan if I'm going to enjoy this. Or they don't like it, and they're like, okay, I'm going to obsessively hate this. And then on the other side, there's people who view other people like that. And I think people like that, I think what's happening is that these people are projecting their own thing. So I think if I'm the kind of person that either goes into stan territory or hater territory with anything I like, that's how I'm going to see everyone I'm talking to. So I think the people that you're describing, who label everyone that they disagree or agree with, you know, as stans or haters, are probably like telling on themselves. Like, they're that to a degree themselves.
Yeah, the thing that always gets me is, you know, there are works of art or movies or music that I like, and I'll think about them and find a way to criticize them. And then someone will say, well, you're just a hater. Well, if I really hated this stuff that much, I don't think I would be investing any time in criticizing it. You know, you have to have some type of interest to critique a piece of popular culture to begin with.
Yeah, and especially like a show. If you try and sit through a show, some part of you wants it to be good. I hope there's not people out there who turn on most of what they watch just in hopes that they're going to hate it, you know?
Well, I mean, hate listening to podcasts is a big thing these days, I think. But
that's interesting. So people will just listen to podcasts like they hate? I guess that happens, because who am I kidding? I've hate-watched stuff. There was a show, Californication, that I started and I hated it, but I just kept watching it for like way too long. So yeah.
Oh, is that's the David Duchovny show with his sex addiction, right?
Yeah, I watched every season of that show except for the last one, because the last one I was like, you know what? I can't hate this show and say that I've watched every single episode. This is ridiculous. So with the last season, I finally stopped. But yeah, I hate watched it for like 5-6 years. And I would just get seething mad every time. I would just keep watching it.
I know you've talked about that on your Twitter, and you've talked about this sort of issue of stanning and versus haters and how there is no middle ground anymore. The other thing I found interesting was sort of your theory that incels are actually part of a broader phenomena of, I guess you call it fuckability politics. Maybe we could talk a little bit about that briefly.
I mean, I think a lot of politics is fuckability politics. Like, for example, even with, and this is not me picking on socialism. I'm just talking about it because I think that's the world that a lot that you and I kind of know and connect on. So it's not me. That's what I'm using as an example. I'm not like picking on it. But I think even like with a lot of this leftism and fail-son talk, people talk about a lot of this fail-son stuff, or to go to the right with the alt-right and the incels and all this stuff. I mean, one of the things that I thought was really good about Chapo was that Chapo, especially when they first started, really had a psychosexual element to it. They really talked about how like there's a lot of psychosexual stuff tied into a lot of the politics that happens. Like, you know, even like with the fixation on Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, like you can tell like all those white right-wing guys are, you know, just like that crazy Latina socialist with her like bewitching cheekbones. Just you know, like there's something weirdly sexual there. Like you're not gonna tell
it's
me
like
that
their brains are melting because they're you know, they're so used to seeing you know, the attractive Fox News host, and their brain just immediately thinks right wing means attractive woman, and then they see an attractive left wing woman, and it just sort of fries their brain cells.
But not just that, she doesn't have that I just baked a cherry pie for the country fair look that, you know, Fox goes for. She's not like a blonde beauty pageant from the Midwest type of look. You know, she's a Latina and stuff. And I find like that kind of almost makes them matter. Like, you know, because I think they probably like to think of themselves as these guys that like a certain type of woman, and she's making them attracted to this Latina socialist type. Because there was that one guy, I forgot who he was. Remember that guy took a picture of her? It was basically a creep shot. And we was trying to talk about her jacket. And,
really?
Yeah, it was some right-wing guy. And he got, like, eviscerated online. But he took a picture of her from the back in a jacket, you know? And he was like, yeah, that jacket doesn't look too cheap, you know? And I guess what he was trying to say was that that jacket looked expensive, and there's no way to tell just by looking for the jacket, you know. But he's like, oh, it looks expensive, what kind of socialist are you? You know, the same way people do with Bernie in his house. But something about the shot and the way it was shot from the back, and how her legs were showing, and his comment and everything, like, I was like, this just seems like a thirst shot. Like you're just a creep taking creep shots, like a thirsty guy, like, and you needed some kind of reason to share it. You know what I mean? Or they created like this weird revenge porn with her face with deep fakes. Where, you know, I guess they just wanted to see her in porn, and they were like making fake nudes of her and stuff.
I did not even know about that. The one that always stuck out to me was, I'm assuming this was done by a right winger. I guess it could have been done as a prank by someone else to make it look like a right winger, but I assumed it was a right winger. There was this artwork that someone made. It was like some deviant art type thing where it's her in nylons and her feet are in the picture. And it just says, if you want a vision of the future, imagine Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez stamping on your face for all eternity. And I'm like,
yeah, that's very specific.
Yeah. It's almost like there's like maybe like a little bit of like a fetish. Dominatrix fantasy in some of this hatred.
This is a good one. Ben Garrison had some weird ones that were very, very.
He had that one. He had one where there was a guy tied to like a mast.
Yeah.
Sort of like Odysseus, like, and he had like Tulsi Gabbard,
Kamala Harris.
Kamala Harris and AOC.
Ocasio-Cortez, and it was so telling on himself. Like, I'm
they're
looking
like
at her.
Scantily clad, and he's, you know, he's like, just his eyes are bulging out. It's very bizarre.
Yeah, exactly. And Donald Trump is steering it, and Donald Trump is saying, we're not going there. But there's something so racialized and sexualized about it. Like, these brown and black ethnic women are using their sexuality to lure like this white man astray. And the ship is labeled USA. And it's called the Siren Song of Socialism. But, you know, it's very interesting that he racializes socialism. And Donald Trump is gonna, I guess, save them. Like, this is kind of an idea to me. Like, Donald Trump is gonna steer them away from this corrupting sexuality of these brown women and stuff. And it's just funny. Ben Garrison keeps doing this with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and they're all so clearly sexual. Like he has a thing for Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I don't care what anybody says. The pictures are just way too sexy.
I thought it was interesting that one cartoon he did had Tulsi, Kamala, and AOC all together, as if they're just the same person. One thing that I get annoyed with when a lot of people I know talk about race, they treat communities like the Latino community or the Black community as sort of like monolithic. And I see that done by a lot of libs and a lot of Republicans, of course, and I've never understood it. It's just bizarre to me. Like, no, there is a lot of diversity of thought, you know.
Yeah, but what's interesting about that is I feel – okay, well, here's one problem I have. I'm not sure if it's right to call – like, I'm declaring this now. I'm not sure how right it is of me to use something like Stupid Paul as an example of the left, because there's a part of them that I feel just kind of want things for themselves, and leftists are going to get it for them. So there's not this real kind of – commitment to seizing the means of production or changing.
No, there's people that claim to be socialists, but really they're, you know, there's a certain type of person that claims to be socialist, but, you know, really, I just want to get rich.
Yeah, exactly. I want healthcare. I want my student loans forgiven. You know, I don't read any theory. I don't know anything about seizing the means of production. I don't really care about any of that, you know. And so I shouldn't really use them as an example of the left. But I was going to say, I noticed like that type, too, will kind of reduce Black people, at least the ones who aren't Adolf Reed, as some kind of monolith. Like, you know, they must think, oh, you must support all these ridiculous identity politics things, you know, if you bring up race as important in any given way. And then, like, you know, the right wing will treat Obama the same as Al Sharpton, the same as Jesse Jackson. You know, because that happens to me a lot too. When the alt-right used to be very big on Twitter and stuff, they would always just say to me, you know, because I was bringing up something about race, and they're like, well, you're fine when Obama did it. And I was like, why do you think that? Like, you know, like why do you think I support Obama? But there's no... It's the same thing with Republicans and liberals, too. Like, I think now with Bernie Sanders in the 2016 election, I think people have kind of realized that the left of center isn't a monolith. But, I mean, there used to be a time where, you know, people thought everyone on the left liked Obama, liked Hillary, you know, and if you weren't a conservative, then you were an Obama and Hillary lover. And that there was no type of splits or schisms and stuff. But, yeah, I mean, I think I think it's kind of tough because, yeah, a lot of people think black people are a monolith and behave accordingly. But I think in some ways, too, I think black people do need to be kind of more of a monolith. As in, like, I really kind of wish black people were more of a monolith because I feel like black people are anything but. And when you're already such a small part of the population, to be so fractious, let me back up a little bit because I don't think I'm making my point very well. But there's this fantasy that I kind of noticed with white genocide and this idea of if we're less than a majority or, you know, less than a plurality, we're basically extinct. And there's this obsession among racists, like since forever, with demographic shifts. And it's almost like flattering that they think that all these races, what they all have in common is this hatred of white people and their power and their dominant structure, when really there's a lot of people in every race who would want nothing more than to side with capital, than to side with white power and whatever against both their own race and other non-white races. You know,
have you ever watched the show Boondocks?
Yes.
I always love that show illustrates how there's, you know, a lot of
infighting.
You know, it goes beyond the stereotype.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. It, you know, and it's like, like the Uncle Ruckus guy. There's a lot of Uncle Ruckus, but even...
I was terrified when I found this political commentator dude by the name of Reverend Jesse Lee Peterson.
Oh, yeah.
Basically, he is the real-life Uncle Ruckus. And I've asked people who were on his show to debate him. I'm like, is he real? Is he sincere about this? And they're like, 100%. And I'm like, I didn't think that there could be a real Uncle Ruckus. It was bizarre to me.
And, you know, I got to say, he's so bad that he reaches the point where even if he's not real, he's real. Because you can't put on an act. Like it's almost worse if he's not real. You know, like if he's not for real, he's doing that as a bit. That's even more sociopathic. Like that's an incredible amount of commitment. You know, I don't think there's any way you can even do that as a bit to that level and not believe it. I believe that with all bits in general. Like you just can't do a bit that long without breaking character, without having some kind of belief in it.
No, I totally agree. I think, you know, I don't think anyone could keep up the facade for that long.
Yeah, because even like Stephen Colbert, like, you know, he was so like over the top sarcastic. Like he never really played it as a real bit. You know what I mean? Like it was like he was very sarcastic and he would break character sometimes. And, you know, like he wasn't like an Andy Kaufman where he played it straight and you didn't know what was going on, you know. But but Jesse Lee Peterson, I mean, that guy plays it straight. He doesn't give any hints, he doesn't give any winks to the audience. So I mean, it's gotta be real. Like whether he's a true believer or he's doing it cynically as a cash grab, there's some kind of dysfunction there.
Well, I wanted to touch on the monolith thing a bit more. I found what you said interesting. You kind of wish that maybe the black community was more of a monolith. I guess the thing that has always annoyed me about people treating different communities as monolithic is I look at, you know, MLK and Malcolm X, and I see two very different people. I look at the Black Panthers and the Nation of Islam. I look at Louis Farrakhan, and I see different. You know, I see big differences between these different people, these different groups. And I feel like there's something dehumanizing about saying, oh, these are all the same.
Yeah, it's there's this thing that I think happens where I think people do that in general too. I mean, because I mean, people do that with white people too. I mean, people, like, there's times where, well, this is one of the things I want to kind of do with the show, right? You were talking about why I was one of the missions with the show, and one of the things I always find interesting is, like, why is race discussions or race talk, why is it always about explaining some kind of non-white person for the benefit of white audiences? And I'm like, what if you did a show about race where a lot of the focus, and I'm not sure how well we've stuck to this, but, you know, we always kind of try to, where it's about explaining white people and how they think to black people. You know, like, what if you kind of change the idea of what race discussion can be, where it's not, you know, just always, hey, white people, here's who we are, or, you know, here's what we think or what we believe and what we want. But just kind of break down white people. And one thing that I kind of find a lot is a lot of non-white people don't really understand the breakdown or nuances of white people. Like, I've met a lot of black people who don't, you know, really understand the difference between, like, you know, WASP Catholics, how a lot of WASP hated John F. Kennedy, and how, you know, different camps of white people, like, don't get along with each other. Like this is a common thing that comes up a lot in debates, is you'll get something where people say, yeah, you know, I'm tired of, like, I'll give an example. There was this thing with Gayle King interviewing Lisa Leslie about Kobe Bryant, and a lot of people were mad at Gayle King for what they thought was an ambush of Lisa Leslie on the topic of Kobe Bryant, that it was tasteless, how she did it, and they didn't like that. In their view, she did all this defense of Charlie Rose and these different people who were accused of crimes, and with Kobe, she did something totally different. And I was watching this call-in show, and it was Yvette Cornell's call-in show, and caller after caller, these black people were calling in saying, oh, I don't think we should be getting on Gayle King like that, you know, because she's a black woman, this and that, and we have to kind of support her, because, you know, you don't see white people, they don't criticize each other like that and getting all this stuff. And Yvette Cornell, the host, she was like, what are you talking about? Like, Rush Limbaugh cheeks on white Harry Reid all day long. White liberals and leftists were critiquing Trump. They were critiquing Rush Limbaugh winning the Presidential Medal of Honor. Like, where do you get this idea that, like, white people are this kind of group that never betrays each other, that never that's always 100% on code 24/7?
Can I yep. give you an mm-hmm. example of that always has stood out for me as someone from Pennsylvania? When I go to, you know, a place like L.A., California, or if I go to New York, and people find out I'm from PA, they'll start ragging on, you know, PA and in Pittsburgh. They'll be like, oh, Pennsylvania, all those, you know, opioid addicts, and they're always unsophisticated, sort of making fun of them for being unsophisticated and whatnot. Especially the more rural areas of Pennsylvania, there's definitely some internecine sort of strife there, cultural differences.
Oh yeah, I'll give you another example. Right, when I was talking to somebody who is not really into like media figures. This is a very intelligent black woman, very well read, very intellectual, whatever, but. She doesn't really follow like the media and the politics. She doesn't know a lot of media figures. So, she was talking about, Joy Reid and Nina Turner and these different people. And she was kind of lumping Joy Reid and Nina Turner, and Simone Sanders is all the same. And, you know, she was like, yeah, you know, all these people, this and that. And I was like, wait, no, Simone Sanders and Nina Turner are so different. You have no idea. They are not the same. And they're both very different than Joy Reid. And then she was like, oh, well, you know, all those black people are spokespeople for liberals, for white liberals. You know, they all believe the same stuff. And I kind of realized she kind of turned them all the same, because to her, every white Democrat was the same. Like, you know, like that nuance of difference between a Biden or a Bernie Sanders or the type of centrist that Joy Reid kind of is always supporting and stuff. Because she viewed the white people they were kind of surrogates for the same, she basically kind of made them into the same kind of black spokesperson. And I was trying to explain to her, like, you know, these camps do not like each other. Like, the Bernie camp does not like the Biden camp. They don't really have much in common policy-wise and whatever. But in her mind, they were just all racist people left of center.
It reminds me of... I remember when AOC first announced that she would be supporting Bernie Sanders, and I believe one of the media questions she got was, you're a Latina woman, why are you supporting an old white male? It was like it just blew their mind. They couldn't understand it.
But also what makes no sense about it is, if she came out supporting Joe Biden, they wouldn't have any problem with it.
Right.
Yeah, it was like, oh, she came out supporting Hillary. You know, they wouldn't say, oh, she's a white woman, you know. But it's like, there's this weird thing with liberals where, for some reason, they think they're honorary everything. And they also believe that, they have this fantasy that I think they really want to believe for some reason, that other people view them as honorary everything too. Like, this is a weird idea they have where they want to believe they transcended the whiteness somehow, to the point they actually start thinking that Bernie Sanders is white and they're not, or Bernie Bros are white and they're not. Like, they'll criticize white people as if they're not white. Chapo makes fun of this a lot, but there's something to it. Like, when Hillary Clinton's people released that terrible thing where they said, was it in Africa, they called her Sister Hillary or whatever. What was it? Was it called? They called her Mama Hillary or Sister Hillary? Do you remember what it was?
I'm not recalling that well, but...
Hold on, I'll find it. Hold on. I want to get it right because it was horrible. But I think it was... It was in Blue Nation Review, and it said, in Africa, they called her Sister Hillary, and it's Blue Nation Review. And everybody was making fun of that headline, but there's something about them. They really want to believe that these communities all over the place think of them as honorary. You know, the whole Bill Clinton, the first black president or whatever, that really flatters their view of themselves, that these other people, whether it's Bernie Sanders to the left of them or Donald Trump to the right, like they're the bad white people. But we're the white people that are, you know, we're basically honorary black people, honorary Latinos, honorary everything. We are... we're authentic. Like, if whiteness is inauthenticity or stiffness or sterility, like, we're vibrant. We're the cool whites. We're the black whites. We're the Latino whites. We're the diversity loving whites. So yeah, it's something really, really interesting about that. That a Bernie Sanders, or sorry, Joe Biden or a Hillary somehow would not be out of line for AOC to get behind. But Same way where they're always criticizing Bernie Bros as white and male, but I mean, how white are the mainstream liberals? Like if you look at people's different campaigns, and you see when you show Pete Buttigieg's campaign or all these different campaigns, it's just overwhelmingly white. The only person I've seen who has a pretty diverse campaign staff right now, like a really diverse one, Elizabeth Warren is going really all in on black women. I am not sure why or how it happened, but she's really trying to make a push for them. So she's like maybe like the one exception amongst the mainstream liberals.
I'm curious, since we're getting into this, do you have any thoughts on... I guess what's been called, I think it was Candace Owens that coined it, this whole Blagexit phenomena and Kanye West. What are your thoughts on that? I'm just curious because I sort of dislike the way that some liberals I know just think that they have sort of an ownership over the black vote. It's bizarre to me. And I'm not saying that in defense of Republicans either.
No, I understand what you mean. I don't think it's even so much... Like, I think ownership is right, but I think it's more an entitlement. As in, it's not even something that you own that, you know... Because there's some things you own, like, you know, your house, but you know you have to pay your mortgage regularly. You don't take for granted that this house is guaranteed to be yours. Even if you own the house outright, if you don't pay your property taxes long enough, you know, you can lose that house. Like this idea is like, I have to maintain this. I have to work for this. This can be taken away. I can lose it if I'm not careful. So it's deeper than ownership. It's this kind of entitlement, like I own this and it's supposed to be mine. I don't have to really work for it. I don't really. It's almost like a right for me to have this thing, and no one's supposed to take it away from me. And I think that's the type of ownership. It's an entitled ownership that I think Democrats have to the black vote, to the point they don't even have to offer you anything. They just have to like scare you by not having them around, because this is kind of idea where they keep trying to scare black people into voting for Democrats by saying, oh, do you want 4 more years of Trump, which to me means, do you want 4 more years of not having us around? But you know, and I always say this to people, I always say, how has life for black people gotten worse due to the fact that they're black under Trump than it has under Obama? Because there's certain things that Trump has made worse for some black people, but it's not really because they're black. Like, for example, there's a lot of black immigrants who have had it worse, but that's because Trump is going after immigrants, and it just happens to be these immigrants happen to be black, you know. But as far as like hurting or helping black people because they're black, like I really can't think of anything Trump has done to make black people's lives worse specifically because they're black, or anything Obama did to significantly help black people specifically because they're black. Like, you know, people might say, oh, Obamacare, but that's not another one of those lift all boats policies. You know what I'm saying? Like when the police brutality stuff was going on, he was very diplomatic and tried not to really have strong words for anything as far as that. He mostly lectured black people all the time to kind of ensure voters that he wasn't going to give them special treatment. Like that's really most of what he did. And so it's like these Democrats, these liberals, I noticed like they feel that just somehow their presence in office is some kind of gift to black people. Like this idea that, hey, you have a Democrat kind of watching over you over a Republican, but realistically, like, I don't think they've really done much recently for black people. And I include Obama in that. Like, I think Trump is worse for a lot of people. He's worse for immigrants, particularly like Mexicans and Muslims. He's worse for LGBTQ. I think he passed a bunch of stuff, including with the military, right? With trans people. He's been banned for a lot of different types of people, but as far as black people, to me, it's been kind of the same.
I guess before we close out, I just wanted to ask you one more thing. I know your show has discussed, and also on your Twitter you've talked about, it seems like there's a little bit of a rift when it comes to, I guess, a certain segment of black feminists and the issue of black masculinity. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that. I've seen some of your recent tweets about it.
I feel like kind of funny about that in a way that, because I feel like it's kind of hard to talk about in this kind of climate, because there is this thing where I think everyone has a tendency to look at things through white lenses, because white people and their dynamics and everything are default and normative in this country. Like, we look at that as like the baseline for everything and try to interpret everything through that. So I think it becomes kind of hard to train yourself out of, and black people do it too, where when you see a black guy talking about something, they view it as if a white guy was doing it, you know, just in like blackface. And what I mean by that is, if a white guy was talking about a certain group of feminists attacking white men, it looks crazy. It looks like, hey, this is up there talking about reverse racism. Like, what are you doing? This is a tacky look, and you look like an MRA or something, you know? And so then if a black guy says, hey, you know, I think feminists, both black and white, because I don't really talk about just like black feminists, but it's more like, actually, I think white feminists are like worse a lot of times with the racism against black men. But this is kind of, I think, reflexive tendency to look at it as, oh, this is a man complaining about what a group of women are doing. Like, this is the kind of idea of thinking there's the same power differential. But the truth of the matter is, like, black men are doing pretty badly. They have been for a while. There's not really this idea, even though a lot of people try to push it, and this is kind of what the pushback is. Like, this is an idea where they want to, where liberals, I think, really want to push this idea of black male patriarchy, that, you know, that this is idea of black men running the black community alongside, you know, like, this almost, I call it a co-patriarch theory, that, you know, white men and black men are like co-patriarchs in arms, and, you know, black men have this investment in patriarchy, and, you know, there's this brotherhood of patriarchy between black men and white men and whatever, and it's ridiculous. That's not how patriarchy works. Like, the idea of a dominant society's patriarchy is to eliminate the threat of anyone else's patriarchy. Like, patriarchy is not a cooperative thing where, you know, white men have traditionally seen black men and said, hey, come and get a piece of this pie, jump up here with us. You know, like, white men have traditionally, even if they were oppressing their women in certain ways, they were way more likely to side with the white woman over a black man any day. And if anything, kill black men on behalf of white women. Like, this idea that black men have power not only over black women, but even over white women is kind of crazy. But people are just saying it uncontested, uncritically, you know? And so, like, even now you have, like, white feminists will be lecturing black men for their patriarchy. And it's like, you know, are you kidding? I would have been lynched 30 years for arguing with you on right now. You know what I mean? You've benefited from white supremacy. Like, white supremacists have been your fathers that you've inherited property from, your husbands who have, you know, given you a life. Like, slave owners have been your children. Like, this idea that you've been this innocent bystander in white supremacy for the past 400, 500 years. Like, it's gotten to the point that's so ridiculous now where I saw this, there was this black girl online who was trying to say, and she got it from her white feminist professor. She was trying to argue on Twitter saying that, black men were inferior to white women in terms of racism, but that black man still had male privilege. This is during slavery times. That the black male slave still had male privilege over the white female slave owner. And everyone's like, what the hell are you talking about? He wasn't even seen as a man. Like, just because he didn't have male privilege over her just because he had certain chromosomes. Like, it doesn't work that way. And it still doesn't work that way to this day. But it's kind of hard to say that because when you say that, people just see it, I think, instinctively, like they see a white guy talking about, hey, it's tough being a man. You know what I'm saying? And so that's been kind of my problem with this discourse that intersectionality has introduced, because they've kind of made this weird additive version of oppression where it's like you take all these oppressions separately and you examine them in a vacuum, but that separation is fake. And what I mean by that is, like, supposedly you're supposed to look at what is it like being this race, which is white. What is it like being this race, which I mean this thing, which is poor. What is it like being this thing, which is male, right? And then you examine those things and then you combine it together and that becomes like your level of oppression. So it's like if you're a black man, you're supposed to take what it's like being black, combine it with what it's like being a man, you know, and that's your level of oppression. But it buys into this idea that gender exists in a vacuum separate from race. Like, for example, if you say combine the experience of a black person with the experience of a male, what kind of male are you talking about? You know, and implicitly what they're talking about is a white man, you know? So it's like, I'm supposed to be black, which means I suffer from racism, but I'm also a male, which means I benefit from patriarchy. But no, the male you're talking about is a white man. Like there is nothing that's just a raceless male. There's not this raceless essential trait of maleness that operates the same across races, you know? And that's the kind of the problem I have with intersectionality is that idea that maleness operates in everyone the same, such that you can just add, you know, black and male and sexuality and class and come up with this thing. So this idea that black women are the most oppressed because they're both women and black, but black men are less oppressed because they have the maleness offsetting it, and white women have it bad because they're women, but they have it better because they're white. You know, like it doesn't really work that way. Like my maleness, being black maleness, is not equal to or more powerful than the white woman's womanhood. You know, it's like the whole framework of it is just, I think, very flawed and divorced from how things work in the real world. Like to give you an example, being female in the form of a black woman can open you up to all types of increased likelihoods of being raped, of not being taken seriously when you try to prosecute a rapist or accused. Like, you might be less believed than white women. When you go to the hospital, black women are shown to be routinely mistreated and underdiagnosed and not taken seriously. Like, there's a lot of specific things that happen to black women that don't happen to black men that make their experience worse. But for black men, there's certain things that are unique to being black and male that they experience, like false rape accusations are wildly black men. Like black men are the most exonerated for false rape. You know, lynchings were far and wide, like predominantly men. They lynched women far, far, far less. So that's an example of how the maleness in a black man adds an extra oppression that, you know, a woman's not particularly facing when she's black. And this is not to make it comparative, to say, I've got it worse than you, you've got it worse than me.
Right, this is right. It's not a contest. It's not
Exactly. Yeah. And that's the thing I want to make clear. Like, but I'm saying that it's not a contest. Like, what I'm trying to say is we both have it really bad. So stop trying to make a hierarchy of oppression between black people, which is why I think it's kind of happening. This is
right. Instead, it should be used to create solidarity.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not doing that. I think what intersectionality has been doing is it's balkanizing the black experience, where it's like, hey, within like black people are 13% of the population. So we're already politically an underdog because we don't really have the numbers to move things like we'd really like to. But now on top of that, you mean to tell me that we're going to balkanize the black constituency, where it's like black women against black queer men versus black straight men versus black disabled people? Like, every intersection is supposed to be its own micro constituency. Like, so at this point, what are we doing? We have constituencies of like 1%, 2%, 4% of the population now. Like, how is any of this going to build any power? And I think it doesn't. And I think that's why white liberals like it so much, because it doesn't really scare them. Like the idea of a black politics where the end result of it is 15 camps of black people who don't get along. Like, what's not to love about that? You know, it's way less scarier than something like black power or something, where black men, black women are all wearing dashikis and putting their fists up and whatever. I think that's how like the liberal wing of white supremacy works, is to push things like that, but make it look like they're giving you medicine. You know, that's my problem with the whole idea of intersectionality in a nutshell.
Well, with all that being said, like, at the same time, I do respect things like the Cumbie River Collective, and I do think there is something to be said about intersectionality. I don't think we're rejecting it all wholesale, or I don't know, maybe you disagree.
Well, this is the thing, right? I'm not against the idea of intersection, the idea of different identities intersecting, and that based on those different types of intersections, you get unique relationships to oppression and privilege. I'm actually all for that. Not only that, I think I believe in it. I think I do practice intersectionality, because I think when I talk about the unique oppressions that happen when you intersect race and maleness, versus the unique intersections that happen when you combine race and femaleness. I mean, what is that? Like what I just did right now, I think that is an intersectional analysis. Like that was intersectional. Like I think what the problem is the idea that only one type of intersectional analysis is objectively right. Like I actually like what Crenshaw and a lot of these other people have done in pushing the idea that not all oppression is identical based on gender, based on race, that different intersections of different identities produce, you know, different outcomes. I'm actually all for that. So that idea, that concept, I thought was very important. My problem comes from the ultimate conclusions and the idea of just adding the different oppressions, but creating these fake raceless categories that don't really exist. Like white poverty is different than black poverty. White maleness is different than black maleness. White femaleness is different than black femaleness. And this idea that you're examining these raceless, I mean, these racist versions of these identities and plugging them into an equation when really they're just unspokenly white versions of those things. Am I making sense? I don't know if what I'm trying to say with the racist versions of these identities is making sense. But I'm not against the idea of the intersection. I think it's actually a great idea is what I'm trying to say. I think there's just room to disagree on your formulas, disagree on
right
how you're coming about. Like maybe you need to move the decimal point here, maybe you need to multiply this instead of add or subtract it. Like I think the differences aren't as extreme as they might seem on the surface, and I'm not saying to throw out the baby with the bathwater. I think there is a lot of value to be had. I think we just have to understand, and this is the other thing, we also have to understand that the point shouldn't be to balkanize and create hierarchies. Like you and I as a black man and black woman can appreciate each other's unique oppressions without having to break things down into a hierarchy. You and I as poor men can appreciate how maybe black poverty affects me a little harsher than your white poverty without having to create this hierarchy where now I have moral authority over. Like I feel like Tumblr did a lot of that, where it's like if you can prove you have the worst oppression, you now hold the speaking stick. You now hold the mic. Everyone has to defer to you, and it becomes a weird power jockeying game and stuff. Like, and
that, I really not to interrupt you, but I really liked there was this song that Ice-T did with his band Body Count a while back called No Lives Matter, and at the beginning he talks about Black Lives Matter and we have to focus on that and that's important. And he also says, and he's not taking anything away from Black Lives Matter, but he's like, if you're poor, the powers that be are going to screw you regardless. The bottom line is that to the powers that be, no lives matter, and that's the name of the track. But he's also emphasizing the Black Lives Matter aspect at the same time. He's saying that there are, I don't know how to put it, but he's saying that different groups face different oppressions, but they're still being oppressed.
Exactly. And you kind of need to kind of figure out what you can unite over if you're going to overthrow anything. Like people now are leading with their differences, I feel. And it's just hyper-balkanization of everything. And at some point, you got to kind of figure out what your commonalities are. How can we coalition build? How can we grow our numbers? Because that's what politics is. Politics is a numbers game. Politics is building bridges. And that's one thing I think the right is good at. The right will try to crush like the left or the liberals or the socialists or whatever first, won't waste time really breaking things down like, well, I think that's a Maoist, or I think that's a you know, third wave feminist, I think whatever. They're just like, hey, that's a shit lib, that's a lib, that's a snowflake, let's just get together and take them down. And then afterwards they'll like, you know, nitpick and fight each other and scrap like to death. But I think when it's time to win, the right wing kind of knows. Whereas like I feel like on the left, and it's getting worse, everyone is trying to litigate all this stuff to death before they win. And we just reached this point now. Like I'll give an example. If you look at Elizabeth Warren's campaign, she has been talking so much about trust black women this, black women that. And I've never seen that before. Like, you used to go for the black vote. That was just what you did. Now there's this thing where people are specifically going for the black woman vote. And she also says something about Latinas being the backbone of the community. She did this event where she was talking all about Latinas. And I was just kind of thinking, like, how far is it going to go? Like, you know, there's a lot of talk about, hey, what are we going to do? XY politician about black trans and all these black trans death and the black trans death epidemic. And then a couple of people actually broke down the numbers, and the black trans people who are dying, they're actually dying at the same rate of the black men in their neighborhoods, because they tend to all live in these, a lot of times the ones that are dying, they're living in these crime ridden, poor neighborhoods. Right. And some people have done like the cross checking of the numbers of black trans deaths versus black male deaths in like the same areas, and they pretty much track. So basically, if you just talk about, hey, what are you going to do about black people dying? You're automatically helping the black trans person and, you know, the black men and everything, because white trans people aren't dying like that. You know, if it's was really about this combination of black and trans causing the problems, first the white trans people will be dying at some alarming rate, and then the black trans person would be dying way more than both of them. But the white trans people are a small part of the trans deaths, and the black trans people are dying at the same rate as the black male non-trans people. So really, at the end of the day, this is black death. It's like one of the oldest stories that there is. But I see Elizabeth Warren giving speeches about the black trans epidemic, and now she's talking about black women this and that, and it kind of worries me. I don't want this to become like the new norm, where it's like you're kind of encouraging people to just think about your combination of three or four identities and believe that the poor person next to you can't understand you, or the poor person next to you can't understand you because they're a poor white person, or they're a poor Latino person, or the black person next to you can't understand your position because they're straight and supposedly privileged, or they're disabled and supposedly a different sub-block. So, yeah, I mean, I'm a little disturbed about that Tumblrization of politics that I think is happening.
Well, I guess in closing, I want to give you a chance to promote Champagne Sharks. And also, I always tell my guests that I like to end on a positive note. I know you were getting a little bit doom and gloom there, and I can understand why. Talking about these issues can be difficult because just, you know, I even think to myself sometimes when talking about issues like race, you know, even I as a white person can end up thinking in those like white default terms and not even realize it. And I want to figure out a way where we can bridge these sort of gaps that we've been talking about during this conversation. Do you think there's any positive sort of way forward is, I guess, what I'm getting at?
Okay, here's the problem I have, right, is, like, when I say a lot of this stuff, you kind of responded the way a lot of white people respond, which is, you know, you say, oh, as a white person, I tend to do this, and you're right. And I think when I say this stuff, the reflexive thing to think is that this is something that all black people have figured out, and this is my failing as a white person, and I have to learn to do the right thing, that something that black people already do. But I will tell you the honest truth, I don't think it's a white thing. I think black people are as prone to think of white as default and normative as a white person. So I don't even think there's something to bridge. I think everybody has to make this change. I think black people have to break that chain, chain of thinking too. Like I don't think white people have a minority on thinking that way at all in America. And if anything,
well,
I know
it's so pervasive that it would get into all the different races. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's so pervasive. Because I mean, the people have to argue the most with about that black male privilege or black patriarchy doesn't exist. I spend most of my time arguing with black people about it. If anything, honestly, I think white people end up being more receptive to the idea than black people do. Because I think deep down, white people kind of understand their power a lot, even if they don't really say so. Like, I think, you know, when I break down, like, what really can a black guy do? What type of systems can a black guy call upon, you know, if he wants to get exonerated for assaulting somebody or something? Like, how many, what's the guy's name? Brock
Turner?
Yeah, Brock Turner. Like how many young black kids can count on getting like the Brock Turner treatment? And I'm looking at a lot of white people, they kind of like will be like, you know, yeah, like black men can't really do anything to me. Like you know, that makes a certain amount of sense. But I think to a certain degree, black people want to believe that they're not as out of the game as they are. So I think it's almost like flattering to believe that, yeah, we do have these hierarchies. We do tap into this type of power based on our sub-identity that, you know, white people have. Like, you know, so I think it's almost more of an investment to kind of believe that we have all these different types of privileges and overlaps, and that our lives are just the white community dynamics in blackface, where I think white people are actually kind of more realistic about, like, you guys are not in the same ballpark right now as far as, like, how much supremacy whiteness has in this. Like one of the most ironic things I find about the whole white ally industrial complex is this idea that white people are supposed to be listening to black people about white supremacy, when, if anything, I think black people should be listening more to white people, because no one really understands white supremacy like a white person. They know where they can go, what they can do, what the limits of their
well, they experience it. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. They experience it. They created it. They benefit from it. They've inherited the rules of it. And the idea that I, as a black person, I'm supposed to be educating white people about white supremacy, I think is like one of the worst tricks that white liberals and black liberals have played on black people. It's comical to me. You know, I can't teach a white person anything about white supremacy. But I'm sorry, I'm supposed to end on a positive note. a positive note that I think is happening is, and I don't want to take too much credit for this, I think I'm more part of it. Because I think there's a lot of this happening. I think on the internet, as much as I complain about the internet and stuff, I think there is such a diversity of black thought and black opinion now in a way that there never was. The whole respectability politics, black liberal type of norm that was what people were treating as the monolith. Like I think the monolith that you were talking about was the kind of civil rights view of anti-racism, the integrationist, assimilationist view. It was a default and unquestioned, even among black people. I feel like there's a lot of room to talk about a lot of different things. Before there was a internet, before there was a alternative media, before there were podcasts like what we're talking about now, something like your podcast, something like a Chapo Trap House, something like a Bernie Sanders movement, and for better or worse, because even something like the Donald Trump movement would not have happened. I'm not putting Donald Trump as a good thing. I'm just trying to show like there's a bad side to it too, but there's also, you know, a good side, which is like there's all these lanes that can be gotten, that can be expanded, and I hope it's a net good, and I think it can be a net good. I like the fact that a Champion Charts can exist and have a following. I like that people can say things and have it entertained, like gatekeepers are not what they used to be. They're trying to reassert themselves in spaces all the time, and you know it's not working. Like money is not the guarantee that it used to be, that you know your voice was going to be the one that was going to get heard. I'm not utopian about it. I don't think I think the democratization aspect of the internet and all this stuff is kind of overstated. Like some people are utopian about it. I think having money behind your voice still unfortunately matters a lot, as we're seeing with Bloomberg, but I feel like there's more of a fighting chance than there was before. Like Bloomberg's in the old days, he would have just buried that stop and frisk narrative and they would have been able to remake his image at will. The fact that he even has to address this stuff in debates now is major to me.
Well, hey, I want to thank you again, T of Champagne Sharks, for coming on Parallax Views. If you can let my listeners know how they can listen to the Champagne Sharks podcast, go right ahead and give them the lowdown.
Oh, yeah, sure, because I forgot to answer that question. You asked me to sell them on the show. One thing that's kind of funny, right? When I go on shows like yours, like you're a great interviewer. You're a very focused interviewer. I really enjoy doing it. You kind of keep me very focused and on the straight and narrow. So I have to warn you, when you tune into Champagne Sharks, we can go all over the place. It's not as focused as this. So, you know, we'll talk about everything from like what we just talked about now, which is politics and race, to talking about pop culture, to talking about like obscure New York hip hop lore and West Coast gangs or mental health and stuff. It's a wide variety of stuff. I mean, I like to think that we keep it interesting, and we always try to come up with alternative viewpoints to stuff. But if you go to patreon.com/champagnesharks, you see our free episodes and our bonus episodes. If you just want the free ones, you can just go to anywhere that you listen to podcasts and enter Champagne Sharks and it'll pop up. We're also on SoundCloud. And yeah, I just want to let people know, like, we talk about a wide variety of stuff. So if we talk about something on one episode that's not your bag, because I know some people have told me, like, their first episode was one where we're talking about 90s New York hip hop. And they're like, oh, I'm never listening to this again. You know, and then someone had to make them try like a second or third one and they got into the groove. Like, you know, just fish around, root around, and, you know, even if it's something that's not in your wheelhouse, listen anyway. You might end up finding it more interesting than you think.
Well, hey, thanks again, T, for coming on Parallax Views.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I really enjoy your show. I've listened to it before, and I liked it.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with T from Champagne Sharks, the podcast that is distinguished but vicious. And I gotta say, if you haven't checked out Champagne Sharks, lots of great material, interviews with folks like Yasha Levine, who's been on our program before, actually one of our earlier guests, episode 20, I believe. Also, journalist Ken Klippenstein made a recent appearance to talk about the FBI's designation of quote-unquote black identity extremists, as well as speaking to T about the abuses of the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, otherwise known as ICE. In other words, T is putting out a lot of great material through the Champagne Sharks podcast. So please check it out, folks. Let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Also, if you can, please, please, please consider supporting me on Patreon. I release some bonus content, mainly the Parallax Views Current Events program, The Week That Was, as well as archived editions of older Parallax Views episodes. I am looking to get a number of new Patreon supporters this month. I really need that support if I want to keep releasing programs at the current rate that I am doing so at. And it would really help me out. This has become a full-time labor of love for me, and it's something I do for you, the listeners. So if you can support me through a Patreon donation, it would mean the world to me. And of course, if you can't do that, don't break the bank. I know it's difficult times that we find ourselves in. You can always review me on Apple Podcasts. That really helps me out. We gotta beat the algorithms, folks. And if you can do that for me, it would mean the world. I need reviews on different podcast platforms. It helps when you make a review, as long as it's a good one. Or, you know, if you have some negative thoughts about the show, as long as it's constructive, I can take some criticism. So if you can, once again, please, please consider supporting me on Patreon. Patreon.com/ParallaxViews, all one word, Patreon.com/ParallaxViews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. new forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.